This is episode number 2 with Ben Benjamin, co-founder and partner of Genesis Alternative Ventures. Welcome to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. My name is Andrew Senduk, a former banker turned tech entrepreneur, and in each episode, I interview the movers and shakers of the venture capital and investment space in Southeast Asia, with the only goal to help you discover how to raise capital like a pro, build better companies, and give you a better understanding of the biggest investors in the region. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. Now let's get started. All right, beautiful people, welcome to another session. I am again excited to sit behind the screen together with my friend Ben Benjamin, who initially started his career as a lawyer at Baker McKenzie and went into the retail space for FDA Benjamin, big retailer, brand distributor for brands like Guess, Marc Jacobs, and La Senza, and now currently is the co-founder and partner at Genesis Alternative Ventures. Ben Benjamin, how is life?
Dude, it's good. Well, not as good as it probably is for you on Bali right now, but good enough.
Good enough. I'm so happy to see you because it reminded me a bit about the last time I physically saw you, which is maybe at Singaporean airport somewhere. Singapore airport or Hong Kong airport, I don't know. Very brief. But how is everything? How's everything on your side? How's Genesis going? How's it been for the last 12 months? Like, what's been going on?
Good, Andrew. First of all, thank you so much for asking me to be on the show. You're a great guy, and yes, we had last met fleetingly at the Changi airport in Singapore.
Changi, yeah.
In the days where travel was still quite common, as opposed to today, but that seems a world away. But good. The last 12 months have been good for Genesis. I think we are in a space today where I think investors all around the world are looking at Southeast Asia and technology and the innovation ecosystem and, really see a lot of potential. And I think that bears itself out in the investment numbers that we've seen in Southeast Asia in 2020. I think it was about 8 billion, which matched 2019, I believe. And, 2018 was, I think, more than that, was about 12 billion US across Southeast Asia. So I think there is a new norm in the investing space for tech in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And coupled with that, and that's generally equity investing, right? I mean, those numbers are really based on equity investors. Coupled with that has been the growth of debt investing, right? Because like every business, makes sense to take equity to grow the business and to expand the business. Also makes sense to take debt, for working capital, for plant and equipment acquisition, capital expenditure, etc. So as with every business, we see that the need for debt is there. Same situation for tech companies in Southeast Asia, and that will continue to grow as the ecosystem continues to mature.
Yeah, it's so interesting. We talked about it briefly before the call, right? About the popularity or the awareness, I think the awareness of debt venture debt actually, as an alternative to like you said, like equity financing or normal venture capital, right? So when you look at globally speaking, we know Silicon Valley Bank, I think, is one of the pioneers, has been around for 30, 40 years, has been playing this game for a long time. And then when you look at Southeast Asia, I think India is maybe also like 15 years in the game, 15, 20 years in the game. When you look at Southeast Asia, there's not a lot of players who are playing in this field, right? Of course, I think there's the DBS and the UOBs, like the big banks who are kind of like dabbing into it. What do you think the reason is why this type of financing is just not yet so popular? Because I think for any, startup in the industry right now, if you would talk about this type of venture debt as an alternative, I think the awareness is not yet there. What do you think that is?
So it's a good question. And couple of things I'd suggest. I think let's take things into perspective. First, the ecosystem in Southeast Asia, as buoyant and dynamic as it is today, really is only, I'd call it, 6-7 years old, really. Yeah. I mean, if you look at it, really started in 2014, 2015. Yeah. Some of the big unicorns started a bit earlier, but that was really the time where, you would start to see some big inflows of capital, lots of companies beginning to found, And you know, those are the good days, right? Good early days.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, 7 years ago, 8 years ago at the most. So really, we are at the very early stages of the innovation economy in Southeast Asia, in our opinion.
Yeah.
So I think that that's one thing to understand. The second thing is, you know, venture equity financing really leads the way. Venture debt is, you know, we look at it as a complement to venture equity. So when the venture equity funding starts to, you know, really hockey stick, venture debt also follows in its wake. So if you look at the US, for example, about 20% of entire financing for tech startups is debt, venture debt. So if you look at these numbers in Southeast Asia, for example, you have an $8 billion equity investment in 2020. You know, if you use the US, if you use the US perspective, that should be about 800 to 1.6 billion annually in venture debt allocation.
Mm-mm.
We're nowhere near that. We're nowhere near that because, you know, what one of the key reasons is that it's a maturing ecosystem. It's relatively young. And as these companies continue to scale, you will see that these companies require venture debt. Now, if you look at the big guys, you know, the Grabs, the Travelocas, all of these guys, all of them have debt financing for sure. I think it's also been published in the media.
Yeah.
It might not be termed venture debt, but it is quite similar. Maybe the lenders don't take equity warrants, but a lot of these companies have debt financing on their books as well. The smaller companies, the Series B, C's, Series D companies that we fund, you know, that's typical venture debt where we provide a loan. An amortizing loan, and we ask for a percentage of that in return for warrants.
Yeah.
So you will I think continually understand that as the market grows, as equity funding grows, as these companies mature, the need for venture debt will become more and more immediate. And as we're seeing now, in fact, we're already seeing a strong demand for venture debt in the ecosystem. And when that happens, I think you'll see competition coming in. And, you know, there are players already in the market in Singapore, Indonesia, and, you know, a lot of family offices and a lot of more traditional debt providers that are, you know, trying to sort of work with these tech companies and provide them a form of debt, not necessarily technically venture debt, but, you know, convertible notes, loans that are securitized. You know, so different forms forms of debt and lending.
Yeah, so strongly correlated, I think, also with the maturity of the industry, right? Where there's more quote unquote profitable, or at least companies that are towards profitability, who could be more suited for this type of financing, right? Because if you look at very pre-revenue or very early stage, it would not be a good match, you think? When we talk about specifically venture debt, typical investment profiles, would it be post Series A, B, or do you think that even earlier could be possible as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I read a PitchBook report about a week or two ago that said two key things. One, venture debt demand was growing faster than venture equity demand. So the venture debt curve was slightly steeper than the venture equity curve in this last 2 years. And the reason for that is, one of the reasons for that is because venture debt is becoming more democratized across the life of a company. So, and the second, and that ties into the second key point, which is that, you know, even pre-A companies are beginning to look at venture debt. There is something called revenue-based financing, where companies take much smaller loan amounts, higher interest rates, no warrants. And they're paid back almost on a 30 to 60 day cycle.
Oh, wow.
You know, there are, as I said, there are different forms of debt that work for different lenders and for different borrowers.
Yeah.
So you can see that, you know, the typical borrower is beginning to change. You know, if you take Genesis as an example, we generally fund to Series B and beyond companies. So Series B to Series D, E, et cetera. We occasionally do fund Series A companies. They've got to be really strong. You know, they've got to have a strong business model in place. We generally like to fund B2B businesses, B2B to C businesses, enterprise SaaS companies. We do occasionally fund B2C businesses as well when they've got a strong model, strong economics. And what we find is that, you know, I think what most lenders will find in many cases, these companies are not yet profitable, right? And if they're profitable at this early stage in their life cycle, it's a problem. I mean, you know, these companies need to be growing, right? Probably at the expense of profit at this early time.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean to say they shouldn't have a sustainable model in place.
Mm.
And they should be able to sort of switch gears at the appropriate time to get to a sustainable level of EBITDA positive cash flow, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
But generally, these companies aren't profitable. They aren't profit making. They could be cash flow positive. They could be, you know, EBITDA break even, but they need funding and they need funding to grow. And whether that's equity and debt for different purposes, that's kind of the typical lender profile.
Yeah. And I think also like when you look at
typical borrower profile, my apologies.
And if you look at it from a startup perspective, of course, because they would say, okay, we need cash, right? We need to raise money, whatever money, wherever it comes from, we need to have it. But do you think that even as a lender, let's say if VC, situation number one, if VC gives, let's say $1 million, situation number two, venture debt firm gives $1 million.
Would the startup treat that 1 million differently? Because one is debt and needs to be paid back, right? And the other one is given in return for equity. So I think that, do you think from your perspective, like should they treat that $1 million differently when it comes from either a VC or let's say a venture debt firm?
I think the practical answer is yes. I think whenever lenders lend funding to these companies, there are usually covenants and restrictions in place. So, you know, we will generally ask that the company use the funding for, you know, general operational requirements.
Yeah. Working capital.
They might have working capital. Yeah. They might have a CapEx plan that they want to execute.
Yeah.
You know, they might want to use it for acquisition financing, right? So they might want to buy another business. So we kind of scope out what the use of funds is for, and we kind of restrict or ring fence those the usage of those funds.
Yeah.
Companies and borrowers are generally very happy to as well have some, you know, working definitions of what that funding should be used for.
Yeah.
So it's a win-win, right? Gives everybody clarity of purpose.
Exactly.
I think the big difference between equity and debt is, you know, when these companies take equity to fund working capital or inventory purchase cycles, let's say, you know, that's a very, very expensive, capital raise, right?
Because,
you know, if you believe in the company and you feel it could be successful and, you know, it could be very valuable in the future, every percent of, you know, stock in the company that you're giving away is a very valuable percentage.
Yeah.
So we generally ask entrepreneurs to think about that and to think about how venture debt can complement, not replace, but complement the venture equity raise.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. So it's actually, like you said, right? These are two different building blocks for a total fundraise, which, you know, venture debt, venture equity could be complementing each other. So could you share more about Genesis in general? So, I mean, your LPs and like, because I know you do different types of stages, but at least let's say B and up, right? Series B and up.
Yes.
But could you share more about, is there a similar LP structure or in the investment horizon? How is it very different than a normal VC structure?
Okay. So we are about 2 to 3 years actually in operations now. So the team has been together for quite a while. We've closed our fundraising some months ago. You know, we're happy to have raised about $80 million for deployment into Southeast Asia companies, tech and tech enabled companies.
Yeah.
We've already deployed as we were fundraising. You know, fundraising is never easy and it takes time. But through that process, we had already started to identify good companies and started to fund them and back them. So we're probably around, you know, we're probably about 40% deployed in the fund right now.
Wow. Yeah.
We've got about 60% left to go. So we have a portfolio of about 12 companies, the majority of which you can find on our website. They are spread all over Southeast Asia. Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam. They've got revenues in all these countries, some really wonderful names, and some really amazing tech. So very proud of the portfolio. Great pipeline of companies. I mean, we talk to founders and VCs every day looking for, you know, debt support. And we go through this list conscientiously, and so really interesting pipeline coming through. In terms of investors, we're very blessed to have a very strong group of, you know, quite diverse investors from around the world, different types, institutionals. We have banks that are invested in Genesis. We have fund of funds. We have corporates. We have charities, you know, registered charities. And of course, we have high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals, and, you know, formal family offices as well. So it's quite a broad range. We're thrilled really to have our LPs on board with us. Very supportive, like the venture debt model.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in terms of how different we are from a VC structure, it's quite similar. We're a GP LP structure. So yeah. Most VCs are like that. And that's exactly how we're structured as well.
That's amazing. Yeah. Cause I bumped into one article which had a nice headline, like venture debt is going to explode in Southeast Asia. And it was actually an interview with one of the guys from Capria Ventures who actually invested in Genesis, right? That's really amazing. No, because like I said as well, I mean, if startups really be aware of this opportunity or this possibility of raising debt, raising money without diluting too much, I think then, you know, it's almost a no-brainer, right? Like, what would be, why not? Why isn't it as popular, right? That's my kind of thing.
No, I think you're right. Look, I think the pushback that we get sometimes is, you know, hey, that's a high interest rate, or, you know, we've got to repay, and the, you know, the lender has got all this power to pull the plug, you know, and stop the party, you know. But the reality really is quite different, and if you talk to experienced entrepreneurs and of course the VCs, they really understand that, you know, venture debt is not a replacement for venture equity. It is a complement. And if a company is raising around, you know, they would reserve 20-25% for venture debt. And, you know, really the interest rate that we charge, it isn't, you know, artificially high. You know, it's, you look at a corporate rates, that the commercial rates that the SMEs are charged, for example.
Yeah.
You know, in Singapore, they're probably, you know, just under 10% or so for the average SME. You know, ours go a little bit higher than that. And that's a reflection of the risk that Genesis as a lender is being asked to take, right? I mean, these are non-profitable companies. They don't have assets. You know, we've got to find a way to adjust our risk. And that usually happens through the interest rate.
Yeah.
And we ask also for a small portion of our loan to come back to us in warrants, which is equity kickers.
Yeah. So it's not.
So that again is a reflection of the risk.
Yeah, well, which makes sense, right? Because you're totally like trading off risks. So that's of course how the game would then works, right?
Yeah.
But let's say let's say I'm a startup and I'm raising. Let's say I just raised the $2 million from Genesis.
Yes.
Would it be that $2 million I need to fully repay that $2 million, or is it like, okay, I need to repay, let's say, $1 million, and the rest is going to be in equity kicker?
Yeah. So how it's structured is, if you have a loan for $2 million, you have to repay the $2 million over, you know, whatever, 24, 36, 48 months.
Yeah.
It's amortized. So we, you know, it's good discipline for the company to pay back.
Amazing.
And, you know, for the CFO and financial guys say, hey, you know, we have a commitment. We've got to make this commitment every month.
Yeah.
VCs like it. LPs like it. You know, it shows commitment and discipline.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, so let's say we ask the company to give us a percentage of that loan quantum in equity warrants, which is separate from the repayment, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But also, we gotta also remember, Andrew, we don't take security. We never ask for personal guarantees from the founders and from the shareholders.
Yeah.
You know, we don't try and put a lien on people's homes and,
and
stuff like that, right? So, you know, we for us, it starts and ends with the company.
Yeah.
You know, the company has cash, we lend money. The company's got good investors, great model, we lend money.
Yeah.
And our remedies in case something goes wrong is limited to the companies. It doesn't extend to the founders and the individuals behind the company.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that is really worth reiterating to founders who sometimes question whether it's a little rich to take venture debt.
Yeah, no, I think that's such a good thing to emphasize as well, because in the traditional entrepreneur stories, they would say, okay, I'm going to mortgage my home to get money for the business. And you put every personal asset on the line to get some cash in. And with venture debt, actually, that is not needed anymore. You have an alternative, at least, right? You have an alternative at least. Which brings me to an interesting topic of risk, right? Which I think is, you mentioned it as well. It's, you take a certain interest, or you charge a certain interest, which is maybe a bit higher than the normal commercial bank would, but it's you're right, because you're taking that risk. How do you internally, because this is very interesting, right? Because any bank or any lender would be dabbing into the PD, the probability of default of the person or the entity that you're lending money to.
Yes.
How does Genesis manage this probability of default, or how do you calculate, or how do you bucket, maybe, okay, put this company in bucket number A, which is maybe not so risky, and this one is in B, which is a bit higher. How do you quantify, and after quantifying, how do you charge then the different type of interest rates to different type of companies?
Andrew, you sound like a professional venture debt provider already.
There you go, man. There you go.
Look, it's a really critical question for any lender.
Yeah.
You know, any lender will need to have a very strict underwriting policy.
Yeah.
You know, we have a very strict credit policy in place. I think we've got the number escapes me, but it's between 25 to 30 credit requirements that we look at. So
these
it's like a checklist.
Yeah.
It's the financial health of the company.
Yeah.
It looks at the probability of default, as you mentioned,
yeah.
The probability of full repayment.
Yeah.
And, you know, we go through every single thing. We've got a checklist of up to, I think, 30 data points where we rank. Some of them are yes, no, and some of them are ranked.
Mm.
And the sum total of that will give us a clear view as to whether, you know, quantitatively and qualitatively,
yeah,
we believe that the company is a good venture debt candidate.
Yeah.
And you know, inherent in your question is the premise that, hey, not all companies should be taking debt.
Yeah.
You know, you have companies that are too young. You have companies maybe that are, you know, really equity-based companies that need to really grow fast.
Mm.
They need to, you know, build a lot of market share. So they do a lot of equity raises, right?
Mm.
You know, that kind of burn sometimes may not be necessarily something that venture lenders could be comfortable with.
Exactly.
You know, the flip side to that is, as these companies get really large and they become, you know, really significant, you know, they might turn to the banks, and the banks or the, you know, larger financial institutions might be willing to take a bet on these guys and provide some credit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, because I think for any investor, there's always this risk element, right? And whether you take equity or you charge interest, you try to compensate the risk element. But the big question is how you quantify that risk element. I think you mentioned two really important things, which any investor would agree with. Of course, it's partially qualitative, and the other one is quantitative, meaning you know, let's say on the quality part, you look at founders, you look at the track record, you look at the soft elements, you know, which maybe also gut feeling plays a big role, because you meet someone, you find his spark or energy or vision or clarity about the industry. And then the other one is more, let the P&L do the talking, right? So when we talk about leads, we talk about deal flow. Like, could you share more on how at the moment you are getting your, you know, the hot leads in? Is it that do you go out a lot? Is it a lot of like outreach, or do you get the flow through the VC network or through other network? Like, how do you get the gems, at the table?
Well, I think like every investor, we've got to go beat the pavements, right? And you know, we do a fair bit of outreach, and you know, there are companies that interest us, there are sectors that interest us.
Yeah.
You know, there are founders that interest us. You know, it's trite that it starts and ends with the founders, and you know, they're really the key, right? And the management team that they assemble around them. And we see that as well. So, you know, that's a key consideration for us. We also get a lot of inbound requests from VC firms and investors who are looking to complement their equity investment with some debt. So a lot of our deal flow comes from, you know, professional investment firms, family offices that are looking for us to co-invest with them. And that's great because, you know, we work very closely with quite a big group of investors, and we make sure that we're triangulating information, you know, to the point about risk assessment, quantitative, qualitative. It just helps you get a better 360 view of the company and the investment process. So it's quite mixed. And we also, of course, get a lot of requests from entrepreneurs. You know, I think some of the repeat serial entrepreneurs, you know, they come to us and say, guys, I'm doing Series A. I'm not raising any equity. I'm only raising debt. You know, they're like, hey, hang on a second. You know, I mean, it's not all about anti-dilution. You know, you've got to have strong equity investors. You've got to have some good VCs. You need equity cash. It's good to have, you know, some corporate governance. It's good to have good shareholders on your cap table.
Yeah.
So again, it's all about complementing each other's strength.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good point. Right. It's not just about dilution. It's not just about protecting your shares. It's actually looking at how the money, and besides the money, how the board members, you know, or how that network can actually elevate or push
your
the next level. I think that's a very good point. So talking about founders and entrepreneurs, I think one of the key elements, of course, for any investor would be betting, quote unquote, betting on the entrepreneur, right? What would you describe as, let's say, your three main characteristics? Like every pitch deck that you see, or every entrepreneur that you meet who could be a potential investment opportunity, what are three things that you always look at that would, you know, that would make you say, okay, a green button to the next stage?
Well, you know, my partners and I have different qualities that we look for. I tend to be quite people-centric, right, in terms of looking at these things. And the three things that I look for, it's funny you asked me, because I was just having a conversation with Martin and Jeremy about this a few days ago. One is resilience.
Yeah.
You know, it is critical to find people who are able to fail and who are able to pick themselves up and who are able to move forward. And, you know, in life is full of these mini and, you know, not so mini failures, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, there is a maxim that says, you know, a track record is not a good indicator of future potential and future results. And, you know, I believe that, you know, sometimes it is about, and this drove me nuts at INSEAD when our professors at strategy would talk about, hey guys, you can do as much as you need to do, but sometimes it's all about luck and timing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that drove us nuts. But again, it is resilience is a key thing that we look for. Founders who are able to adapt themselves, and that leads me to the second point: flexibility. Right. You need to have founders that are flexible enough, you know, to be able to see where the opportunities are and you know, make slight deviations to very well thought out, very well laid out plans.
Yeah.
You know, some founders can be very rigid and very inflexible and say, hey, no, this is the plan. We're going straight. No deviations.
Yeah.
You know, we also want founders who are able to ignore the bright, shiny objects and not get too distracted. But it's a fine balance. And I think the third thing is teachability. You know, or you know, the ability to you know, the want to learn. I think, you know, you have some founders who are very open to not advice and not guidance, you know, but, you know, there's people who can recalibrate their thinking and recalculate, you know, like Google Maps, recalculating, you know, we like to see that curiosity and that need for knowledge. And, you know, they want to understand what's best practices and what's really bad. And what don't you like about our company? You know, we want companies, we want to back founders who are insightful, curious.
Yeah.
And again, that ability to learn, constantly learn.
I love
that. So those are my three points. Yeah.
I love that. I think that is, you know, I think everyone, any entrepreneur would always has a vision, is kind of stubborn in his or her own way, right? But I think the last one, being teachable, is of course one of the core, you know, being agile in that sense, right? To really adapt.
Yes, absolutely.
And new inputs, right?
Hey, by the way, you know, you mentioned something, right? I mean, which I agree with, you know, sometimes founders need to be stubborn as well. They need to be able to say no to people and be, you know, very strong about where they want to go. So, you know, again, it's that fine balance
that
you want to try and identify, you know?
Yeah. I had a chat with a VC friend, and he said, like, oh yeah, let's say you have $50 million to spend. Like, what industries would you spend it on? What would it be for you? And now, let's say you look at it's not even. Let's say you have 80 million. You have 80 million to spend. Like, what are the key industries that you're eyeing on that you really feel that this is going to be a big wave in Southeast Asia?
Well, you know, it's first of all, at Genesis, we tend to be quite vertical agnostic, so okay. we tend not to prefer any. Yeah. Exactly right. We like the diversification opportunity. We think that there's a lot of activity happening across the verticals, but I think also if you look at, you know, what the thematic verticals are today as opposed to 5 years ago or 10 years ago, which really is a reflection of, you know, where you are in that life cycle of the ecosystem. You know, clearly food tech. You know, Singapore is going through the Singapore 2030 plan with you know, food security. So food tech, food technologies, food. So I think really we have tried to look for some interesting food tech opportunities in Southeast Asia. Also agri-tech. I think you have, you know, we're a Southeast Asia fund. And we look at, you know, in ASEAN at least, you know, you've got 600 million people. It's a largely agrarian agricultural economy. You know, agri-tech has a huge, huge place in the innovation ecosystem. So, you know, we're very much trying to look for agri-tech, not just in Southeast Asia, but in the Valley, in Israel, and looking to see how we can support some of these companies to come over here in Southeast Asia, HQ here, and fund some of their growth in the region.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know, we've done that, for example, with Matterport. Matterport is a digital capture company based in Silicon Valley. But when they wanted to come to Southeast Asia, HQ in Singapore, we said, great, we're going to provide some debt funding. And, you know, we helped them with quite a few introductions, not that they needed our help. They're a big company and they really have a strong view on where they're going. But we like to do that. We like to sort of help companies come in and fill some of the gaps.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. Because you mentioned a bit about also like the 5-6 years ago, kind of like we're in the early days, right? And what I see, and I'd love to hear your thoughts as well. Like what I see, even when we talk about funding as a whole, so just fundraising as a whole, where let's say in 2015, right, where my partners, like we raised around a Series A round back then of $15 million Series A, which back then was like, wow, guys are amazing, man. $50 million. But nowadays, I recently read like one logistics startup in Indonesia did a Series A, $170 million. And I just read another logistic player, I think it was Jakarta Post or JNE, and one of the big players raised a multi-billion dollar round. Like, what do you think? I mean, looking at maturity of the industry, for sure, I think we see a lot of eyeballs going into the region, you know, a lot of capital flowing in. What is your take on, you know, where the market is going? Like, are we overheating a bit? Like, are those, because if you raise 170 million, we're talking about a like 500-600, maybe $700 million company, right? Which is maybe which is quite serious money, right? So what is your feel on the temperature within the region when it comes to fundraising, and of course linked to that, valuations?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think you're being too modest when you say 15 million now is not any, look, 15 million is nothing to scoff at.
No, it's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, especially at Series A for any of these companies. Yeah. So good job back then and good job now if you had done it now. But I think, look, who knows? I mean, you know, you talk to so many people who say, oh my goodness, valuations have become so crazy and frothy and so high, you know, and there's just too much money chasing too few deals. And clearly you see some elements of that.
Yeah.
And then you have another group of people who are like, absolutely not. You know, technology is the way of the world. It's the way of the future. Yeah. You know, it's, of course, there's going to be some readjustments, but you know, these tech companies are exactly what's going to keep propelling us into the future. So these valuations are absolutely justifiable, defensible. We believe in them. These are the growth rates, etc. So what can I tell you? I mean, we kind of look at, I guess it's probably, we probably take the view that we look at company by company. And we look very carefully and we ask ourselves, you know, is the valuation justifiable? And, you know, being a debt provider, you know, to an extent, we kind of are able to, you know, look past the valuation.
Exactly.
The valuation question, right?
Yeah.
Mean, for us, it's really one of the keys is repayment and the ability to repay successfully. Yeah. So, you know, for us, it's really about cash flow, you know, financial health, financial maturity, discipline. You know, those are the things that we look at. But don't forget, we have the warrants.
Yeah.
And those warrants are our equity in these companies. Yeah. So we do care about the valuation for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the biggest misconceptions is that the venture debt investors are short-term investors. That's really not true.
Hmm.
You know, the equity warrants that provide us a lot of our upside, you know, these warrants are alive for 7 to 10 years sometimes. Yeah. So we are long-term investors in these companies and we want to see them do well.
Yeah.
So back to the valuation conundrum. Who knows, man? I mean, people said winter was coming 2 years ago and it looks very much like summer now.
Yeah, that's true. No, I totally understand when you say like valuation. Of course, it matters also for what you do. But I think it matters quote unquote less than like a traditional VC who's really playing that valuation game and trying to, you know, exit the shares in another round or, you know, even bring it to IPO. So could you like maybe on a high level, could you take me through the selection stage on, you know, when you decide to go forward with a pitch deck? You know, I mean, you see many pitch decks, you talk a lot of entrepreneurs, but, you know, we talked about those three characteristics, right, of entrepreneurs that you look at. What is kind of like what are the main stages of coming to that decision where, you know, the whole team is going to say green light, we're going to write a check?
Oh, well, it's dude, you're asking us to give you our entire investment thesis.
that's why I said high level, not potential, just high level.
Listen, it's wide. I have to say it's wide. So, you know, at the conversation stage, the discussion stage, you know, we obviously want to understand, you know, the key data points about the company, where they've been, you know, what their funding round looks like, where they're going, what the general plan is. You know, I think at that point, it also is a very good time for us to get some leading signals from the founder and whether, you know, we think that the founder or the senior team is, you know, is bankable and we can work with them.
Yeah.
Also, you know, who's the introduction coming from? You know, if it's coming from a really good investor who we've worked with before, you know, with the partner, especially in that firm, for example, you know, that's already something that gives us confidence to look at these companies and these founders. So it depends at the stage, right? So at the early stage, it's all about high level thinking. It's about, you know, what kind of vibes we get from the founder, you know, stuff like that. Once we get past the term sheet stage, you know, we really deep dive into the company's books. We work closely with the VCs who are already invested. They've done a lot of the diligence. So we tend to share a lot with them and they with us. We look a lot at the financial metrics of the company.
Yeah.
You know, you have, you know, business plan, long-term viability, you know, all of those things. That's great. We need to understand that very well. We also need to understand cash flow, gross margins, you know, what's fixed, what's variable, what can you switch off when times get bad?
Yeah.
You know, what's your cash position looking like? How have you been able to keep or spend cash in the last 12 months? And what does it look like in the next 12 months? So, you know, we look at a lot of these things at the post term sheet stage. And then I think towards the very end, we want to make sure as we're signing these documents that everything that we've spoken about, understood, been made to understand from these borrowers is coming through in the performance of the companies as we're about to sign. And, you know, of course, there's going to be shifts and variations, but that's generally the process. And that's generally how we look at and assess these companies.
Yeah, that's nice. I love the word bankable, which reminds me also a bit about the market in Southeast Asia, maybe specifically even Indonesia, where, you know, they talk about the bankable and the unbankable market, right? Which of course the unbankable ones is where the high potential is. And I had this interesting discussion with a friend of mine who we were talking about China. We're talking about, okay, Indonesia is lagging a bit behind. How many years behind? Maybe 10 years behind China. But the growth and the size of the
of companies and impact that are happening in China eventually will happen in Indonesia. That was kind of like the hypothesis, right? We had a very good discussion about why is China that far? Why can they make such companies and such? Why is there so much value creation there and not yet in Indonesia? And he was talking about education, right? So if we look at, because everyone is going to say like, okay, technology is the way forward and, you know, all these companies will add to a better life. What would you say from an investor perspective would be the main challenges or obstacles that we as a region, as Southeast Asia, need to overcome to actually, you know, make those statements reality? Because I think on the macro, on the macro level, everyone will agree technology is the way forward and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But of course, there's a huge gap between that macro statement and the micro actions of entrepreneurs that they're doing daily, right? And also even investing. What do you think would be like the main obstacles to jump towards the levels of, let's say, China or India?
Well, I think one of them is going to look. I think first of all, you know, Southeast Asia is much younger in our journey than China and India. So actually, gives me a lot of. You know, a lot of hope when I look at China and India and I look at what they've been able to accomplish.
Yeah.
And I think that Southeast Asians are no less capable, no less creative. And will be able and absolutely will get there. But I think one of the key challenges that we as a region have, and I say region because, you know, Singapore, small market, rich country, you know, high consumption. But you know, you look for companies that can scale past Singapore, right?
Yeah.
That can scale into Indonesia or Vietnam or Philippines. Yeah. And, you know, I've just mentioned the three, you know, largest population countries in Southeast Asia, right? So everyone's looking at these countries to see how, you know, can the business move into these markets?
Yeah.
And that brings me to the key issue, or rather what we think is probably the key issue is integration and scalability, right?
Yes.
You know, it's one thing to talk about Southeast Asia as a region and compare it to China, one country, India, one country.
Yeah.
No question. Massive countries,
cities
within countries, countries within countries, billion people population. So, you know, similar, sometimes you have similar themes going through, right? But, you know, in Southeast Asia, you're looking at different political systems. You're looking at different currencies, different tax rates. You're looking at different rules of doing business. You're looking at different, you know, everything is different in Southeast Asia. Nothing is the same from Indonesia to Vietnam. You know, so, you know, the common law countries have some similar legal foundations and legal theory, Singapore, Malaysia, for example. But, you know, apart from that, it's really different. Every country has its own challenges and embedded in that are, you know, fundamental differences in all the things that I've just mentioned. So, you know, not only do you have to be good at you know, managing the business and the business and economic fundamentals of that market itself, you've got to also navigate, you know, a whole bunch of legal and quasi-legal.
Absolutely.
You know, so it requires a lot of thought. And I think one of the biggest dangers that we see is, you know, companies coming out the gates and saying, we are only interested in being in Indonesia because that's where all the money is, 300 million people. And we're just going to build it out of Singapore and we're going to just, you know, expand into Indonesia. And, you know, that's very, 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 very challenging to do.
Yeah.
Right. You have to have a very clear view of the market.
And, yeah, exactly.
You know, what you are and what you're not.
Yeah. Even the difference between like tier one cities and tier two, three cities. I think that's already a whole different ballgame when you talk about Indonesia, right? I mean, So I think to kind of like translate it a bit, I would say it would be more about being able to localize your strategies from an operational perspective, from a legal perspective, from any type of perspective, right? Really localizing within the region because there's so many different rules, different countries, different people, different cultures, and if as a company, you are able to localize it, you know, rolling out regionally, but building it locally. I think if you can, if you can crack that code, then you would be on your way to move forward.
Yeah. But I think with this one, sorry, just one last point.
Yeah.
I think the devil is in the details with this one, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of people will, yes, we can localize. We've changed our marketing spend. Yeah. We know what the channels are, or we've hired locals and, you know, we've got local advisors and yes, we have localized. You know, there's one thing to localize and there's one thing to actually really understand locally what's required. Sometimes that does not, I mean, again, to use Google Maps, does not compute.
Talking about detail, I mean, you come from the retail industry, right? And retail is all about detail. What has been, I mean, from being a lawyer going into like retail and doing like luxury brands and corporate strategy, you know, and moving into an investment space, what has kind of been the biggest learning so far? I mean, the fund itself has been 2-3 years old.
Yes.
You're an extremely smart guy. So you're very,
thank you,
very diverse.
I don't know about that.
very diverse developer. What has been, because the investing game is a bit of a new game in that sense, right? I mean, the fund is quite new. You're learning while you guys are also doing, right? So, but what has been the biggest light bulb moment?
Okay, well, good question. And let me be a bit introspective and philosophical now.
Yeah, I like that.
well, I guess the law teaches one how to be methodical, careful, you know, unemotional in your thinking, and really trying to identify the key issues, how to overcome them, how to defend them, etc. So it's a really sort of analysis of, you know, the key items that you want to address, right, in the law. You know, fashion retail, you know, it's much less glamorous than what people think, right?
Yeah.
I would say it's about 90% retail, 10% fashion, right? And retail really is all about, you know, efficiency, productivity.
Yeah.
It's all about people. You've got to manage teams of people all around the region.
Yeah.
You know, it is a very, very, it's a very 360 game, right? And I would say that one of the key skills that being in the retail business has taught is, you know, number one, actually people. You have to be able to manage people, your staff, your customers, your principals, the brand owners, landlords. You know, these are people that you need to have a very strong ability to connect with. And make your views, your strategy known. You got to get people to buy into that, right? And the other thing about what I did in retail, which was really very interesting, is you have to be able to spot the right opportunities.
Yeah.
You have to be able to get the right brands, and you know, you have to be able to see if this business can work in Southeast Asia. Localization, you know, it's critical. Not every successful brand in Europe or the US will translate in Southeast Asia. And with that comes the whole investment thesis, right? You're going to have to spend a lot of money building a lot of stores, buying a lot of product, hiring a lot of people, marketing a lot. You have to be able to understand the operational opportunities, right? And then you start to operate these businesses and you really are able to compare what was actual and planned.
Yeah.
And then you get a really strong sense of how do you operate businesses in reality, as opposed to a business plan.
Yeah.
Right. So now when I've begun in this investing phase, which I think I started about 2013, 2014, more on the equity side, more on the family office side.
Yeah.
And then we transitioned into equity and debt. And now, you know, obviously with Genesis, you know, that all of those things have been fundamental to my practice, right? The ability to really, you know, identify the key issues, the ability to, you know, engage with people successfully. And, you know, there's a lot of people with a lot of ego in this business, as with all businesses, you know, the ability to spot the opportunities and the ability to really understand operationally, how do you operate a business and how does that look different from it on paper or a computer screen?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a different guise. It's a different, you know, sector, but, you know, the fundamental skills, the fundamental kernels are there. And of course, I've got great partners in Martin, Jeremy, and we've got a great team in Eddie and a few of the other guys. And, you know, they bring a very different and diverse viewpoint, right? They're very financially driven.
Yeah.
They've got a very clear view on venture debt and the ecosystem and technology companies. And so when we put all that together, we believe we have a very interesting you know, sort of like a very wide view, very wide lens on yeah. how to look at these companies.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's a good mix, right? And like the Avengers, everyone has their own strength to bring to the team, right? That's how teamwork works. Looking forward, like say 5 years from now, like where do you see Genesis within the investment space? What's kind of like your view, let's say, on the quote unquote near future, let's say 5 years from now? What is your ideal situation?
Well, I think companies can be successful on their own, and companies can be successful within the ecosystem. And I hope that Genesis will be successful within a successful ecosystem. I hope that the whole ecosystem can grow.
Yeah.
You know, I hope that talented founders will stick at it, and they will continue to build their companies. And if they fail, they will get up and do it again.
Yeah.
I hope that investors will continue to love Southeast Asia and the promise of Southeast Asia. And they will continue to invest and take these companies to greater heights. You know, and I wish for Genesis that we will continue to be able to stay true to our mission and to back really strong technology founders and companies in the region. And I think if there is one area I hope that we can up our game, and that's in the impact space. Okay. I don't know if you're very familiar, Andrew, but Genesis also has an impact mandate in our fund structure.
Okay.
When Capria and VC invested in us, and you mentioned that earlier in our conversation.
US-based VC. You know,
that's it. They're a US-based fund of funds, and they're VC themselves. And they have the best impact investors in them in their fund, right? So you're looking at IFC, you're looking at... they've got Ford Foundation, outstanding investors in their fund. And they brought impact to us. You know, they said, guys, look at this. You know, doesn't mean because you're a lender, doesn't mean you won't be able to pursue an impact agenda. And we loved it. And we really deep dive. We really sort of understood what they were trying to do. And we welcomed them into the fund. And together with that, we have now an impact mandate. And what we seek to do is we seek to invest in companies that are clearly growth-oriented and profit-oriented. We have to tick that box first. But if we can find a company that has that and together with that has a strong, impactful angle where they benefit society and they benefit, you know, mankind in their own ways. And that's something for us where we are very keen to fund those companies. The key criteria is that impact has to be embedded in the business model. So as the business scales, the impact scales.
Yeah.
So we say profit first, impact at scale, right? Yeah. We want to be able to see really good companies and strong growth companies that have a really solid impact angle that are making a difference. And it is my hope that we're going to be able to bank and fund more and more of these companies as they appear and as it becomes, I think, more pressing in a COVID environment.
Oh yeah, I love that. That's a really good topic to touch upon as well. At the end of the day, I think with fundraising and startups, people can get distracted by the silver linings or the all the nice headlines. But I think at the end of the day, if the ecosystem evolves and we can drive more towards impact and really changing the world in a good way. Then Genesis would be happy to play a part of that and really funding those initiatives. Ben, one final question before we round up. We fast forward not 5 years, but we fast forward like far, far away in the future, right? And I'm trying to Google Ben Benjamin, but there's like a blank page. And I tried to Google Genesis, and there's a blank page. But besides the blank page, there's actually only three things that I can find. And those three things are three lessons that you want to leave the world with. Like, what would those three lessons be?
Oh my goodness, that's really tough one, right?
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, there is I heard this fantastic thing. I can't remember who said it, but there are CV qualities that one wants to leave behind. You know, intelligent, hardworking, adaptable, and skillful, and was a fantastic entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And then there are the qualities as a human being that one wants to leave behind. And, you know, when you look at a tombstone, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, it is the second, it's the second bucket, right?
Yeah.
So I guess as a human being, the the human qualities are things that I really want to be able to take through in the business together with my partners, right? So, you know, it's being able to, I guess it's really being able to spot deserving people and deserving ideas and really try to get them to make the best of themselves. It's to be able to make an impact in our every dollar that we invest. You know, there are some of those dollars that are going to be non-impactful, and that's fine. But I'm hoping that we will be able to increase the proportion of impactful investment dollars that we will be able to put in Southeast Asia. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to be part of that process where, you know, lines of poverty begin to be raised, and, you know, people sort of have much more, you know, meaningful and easier lives, you know, as they come out of poverty and in Southeast Asia. So I think that's really a personal ambition, which I think will tie in nicely with the mission at Genesis.
I love it. At the end of the day, reminds me a bit of the fact that, you know, we are, that life itself is not the end goal. It's really what we do with our life is the end goal. And that life itself is just a tool for us to, you know, to spread the gospel in that sense, to spread good things and to make a positive impact. Ben, I want to thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time. I always appreciate you. Happy that we're connected again, and I hope to see you soon.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you so much for having me. It was really, really good being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for listening to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, then make sure to share this with a friend that you think would be inspired or could learn something from this. And make sure to subscribe to the Masters of Cashflow podcast over on Apple or on Spotify. And I'd really appreciate it if you can leave a rating and review on Apple and let me know what your biggest takeaway is of this episode. I'm going to leave you with this quote from Walt Disney. All our dreams can come true if we have the courage to pursue them. I'm so grateful for you and wish you courage in building and pursuing your dreams.